Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's almost nothing you can't have on your iPod or near at hand these days. Hot music, the news, this show. Jim Holt knows that, says it's fine, but he's stumping for something more, something ancient, something so old it's new again. Memorizing poetry. He does it all the time. He knows it may seem eccentric. Try it, he says. It's a joy. This hour On Point, poetry by heart. You can join the conversation. Have you tried it? What's it do for you? Do you know a favorite poem by heart? Let's hear it right here, right now. Joining us from New York is Jim Holt. He writes about science, philosophy, and humor for The New Yorker magazine. His latest essay about memorizing poetry appeared in last week's New York Times Book Review. Jim, welcome back to the show. Great to have you.
Oh, very nice to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor of The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to have you as well.
Hello, Tom and Jim.
Sometimes it's amateur, sometimes it's prose, and not always planned. Here's that famous clip of Robert Frost at John F. Kennedy's inauguration, January 1961. He was about to read a poem, a new poem, dedicated to the new president, was having trouble reading it in the bright sunlight there on the Capitol steps, stumbling. So he stops and instead recites from memory his own famous poem, The Gift, outright.
This was to be a preface to the poem I can say to you without seeing it. The poem goes like this. The land was ours before we were the land. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia, but we were England, still colonial.
Robert Frost on the steps of the Capitol at the inauguration, January 1961. 1981, Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams plays John Keating, a newly hired English professor teaching at the stodgy Welton Boys Prep School. His young students don't know what to make of the animated professor and his love of poetry. Here he is in action.
Now, language was developed for one endeavor, and that is... Mr. Anderson, come on, are you a man or an amoeba? Mr. Perry.
To communicate...
No! To woo women.
Okay, Robert Frost, Robin Williams. Two different takes. One inaugurates a president, the next just having fun. Jim Holt, you've memorized a lot at this point. We know it from your essay. Have you always done it? Did you begin to do it? Why?
Yeah, first let me say it's no good for wooing women.
right, they
don't believe anything Robin days, Williams
right.
says. Yeah. I started doing it a few years ago. I was a journalist in residence at Berkeley, and I had to walk a lot because I didn't have a car.
Yeah.
And when you walk around New York City, there's always something to fascinate you. There's always something to engage your attention. Berkeley was rather boring, so I thought, how can I while away the hours that I'm walking? And I thought, I'll try to memorize some poetry. And, you know, I've always loved poetry, but I feel I've never loved it as much as it deserves to be loved because – when I read it in an anthology, I you know, you see it on the page and you read it to yourself and you don't really understand a lot of it and you don't really have that intensity of engagement. I thought if I learn it by heart, it'll somehow be lodged in my heart. And even if I don't understand the, you know, verbal hocus pocus of mm-hmm. someone like William Yeats, mm-hmm. I'll feel, you know, I'm channeling him somehow. And so this was my ridiculous idea. And when I was in high school, I don't know, I'm a baby boomer, so I was at the end of the era.
Pre-iPod.
Yeah, and students were made to memorize poetry. And mm-hmm. in high school, I had a teacher named Mrs. Daniels, and she made us learn a Shakespeare sonnet. She made us learn the first 16 lines of the Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. And we howled and whined and protested. You know, how can you subject us to this? Are you a sadist? And we would have to learn the whole thing in one night.
Right.
It's very hard cramming even a sonnet into your head in one night. But I thought, wait a minute, it's painful if you do it that way, but maybe if you divide it up into little bits, it might be pleasurable. Sometimes a stimulus that's painful, if you mm-hmm. lower the intensity, mm-hmm. it begins to become pleasurable. So I said, okay, I'll try a line or two a day.
And exactly,
I've been doing that for the last...
You read it and then head out the door for your walk over and over until they're part of what you know.
I sort of knock the line or two into my head before breakfast, And then when I go out jogging in the morning along the Hudson River, and I try to I hook those lines on to the lines I already have. And, at first it's a kind of sing-songy mechanical process where you don't really pay too much attention to what the words mean, and you stick very closely to the meter, the ba-bum, 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 ba-bum.
Right.
But then after a while, you feel you're performing it. You're like an actor on stage, and you try to put some expression into it. And also, the rhythm of the words themselves doesn't exactly go with the rhythm of the meter. There are always subtle tensions, and a really ingenious poet like Yeats or Alexander Pope will find ways of bucking against the meter and intensifying meaning. And when you start to feel that, it can be it's exciting. It's heart-wrenching. It's a completely amateur pursuit, but that's my case for it. not painful. It's pleasurable.
Would you be prepared to pull one out of your software, your soul, your memory right now for us?
By the way, my memory has become very good for this.
Good.
But there's a part of the brain called the limbic system, which is the emotional part of the brain, to put it crudely. And the limbic system can interfere with the memory system. So if I falter, blame my limbic system.
You're on the spot. Fight. We'll go after your limbic
system. Let's see what would be a good one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. A very short one by Yeats, which figures for people who've read the novel Ulysses, you'll remember its significance. It goes, "Who will go drive with Fergus now and pierce the deep wood's woven shade and dance upon the level shore? Young man, lift up your russet brow and lift your tender eyelids, maid, and brood on hopes and fears no more. And no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery, for Fergus rules the brazen cars and rules the shadows of the wood and the white breast of the dim sea and all disheveled wandering stars." I'm an amateur. This is the first time I've done it other than, to myself when I'm jogging. Even when I'm jogging, I get very quiet when other joggers are passing me. So
I'm muttering softly. But if that's murder, bring it on, Jack Beatty. There it is. Jim Holt produces the very thing itself, the poem from his mind, from his memory.
The first thing to say about it is it's damned impressive.
Yes,
and
it is.
That's the part of this that I think you didn't mention in your piece, but there's a social utility to memorizing poetry. People pay note. I mean, they think, my God, that's an educated human being. And I know myself, I have parlayed maybe three lines of memorized poetry into a wholly undeserved reputation for, literary erudition. And it's true because all of us have difficulty memorizing things. And if you hear someone come out with a yard of Shakespeare, I tell you, there's a status attaching to that.
Jack, have you got one? Your three lines? Will you share those that have won you your reputation with us?
One of them is from Philip Larkin, the very dark English poet of the post-imperial era, the years of England's decline, and he writes, "They expletive deleted us up." Your mom and dad.
Your mom and dad.
They do not mean to.
They may not mean to, but they
may not mean to, but they do. They give you all the faults.
No,
they
fill you with all the faults they had.
All right, just for you. Then add some extra just from you.
But they were fouled up in their turn by fools and old style hats and coats.
Half
the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man, hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself.
Wow, great. We're right at heart to edit, expletive deleted on air and recited at the same time, but that's great.
No, a poet, I forget who it was being interviewed on BBC Radio, and he was asked what his favorite poem was, and he said, "It's This Be the Verse by Philip Larkin," that very poem, and he recited it with the expletive undeleted, and they had to delay the broadcast until the 11 p.m. time slot.
Let's get a call right here from Manchester, Connecticut, and Mark. We've just got a couple minutes before the break. Mark, what have you got?
Back when I was a young man, I had a mentor named Joe Santry. He's living up in Brattleboro right now, but he turned me on to Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Okay.
And his book, A Coney Island of the Mind, Pictures of the God World. It's one of my favorites.
You got something memorized there, something short?
Yes. The sensual phosphorescence my youth delighted in now lies almost behind me. like a land of dreams, wherein an angel of hot sleep dances like a diva in strange veils through which desire looks and cries. And still she dances, and dances still, and comes to me with breathing breasts, hot lips, and upright eyes.
I love it, Lawrence Fairlane. Get it. And when you recite that at bars, does she come in manner thusly, Mark?
Oh, they all do.
Yeah, seriously. Jim Holt says it doesn't work.
I got one more short one for you.
Quick, make it quick. Let's hear it.
Peacocks walked under the night trees in the lost moonlight as I went searching for love that night. A ring dove cooed in a cove, and a clock tolled twice, once for the birth and once for the death of love that night.
Hey, you rock. Is that Ferlinghetti also, Mark?
That's Ferlinghetti also.
Beautiful. From a Coney Island of the mind.
The candy store beyond the L is where I first fell in love with unreality. Jelly beans glowed in the semi-gloom of that September afternoon. A cat upon the counter walked among the licorice sticks, Tootsie Rolls, and Old Boy Gum. A girl ran, her hair was rainy, her breasts were breathless in the little room. Outside, a wind had swept away the sun. The leaves were falling, and as they died, they cried, too soon, too soon.
You rock, it's great. You can be a cat on our counter any time, Mark. That's just awesome.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare. And the women, you will wow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about learning poetry by heart before and beyond iPods, the unique pleasure of reciting poems from memory, and we hope you will share yours with us. Jim Holt is here, and a wonderful essay in the New York Times Book Review. He's author of Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes. And let's get a call right here from Spokane, Washington, and Mary. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be on the air. I love this topic. I'm so glad you're talking poetry today.
Good. What have you got?
Well, one of my favorite poets is John Keats, and I think his poetry is the poetry to read aloud. Keats really focused on the sensory experience of poetry.
Jim Holt says, hear, hear. He agrees. Have you got one from memory, Mary?
I do. It's very short. It shows the dramatic nature of some of Keats's poetry. It's called This Living Hand.
Let's hear it.
This Living Hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping. Would, were it cold and in the icy silence of the grave, so warm that... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm so nervous, I must stop.
That's your limbic system, no problem.
Yes, it is. Thank you for the limbic system comments. I really appreciated that. Can I try one more time? It's very...
Absolutely, roll on.
Thank you. This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the grave, so chill by night, days and... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't make it.
A noble effort and a wonderful selection. I think that was the last poem Yeats wrote before he died.
Keats.
What am I saying? Keats.
And it had a lot to do, I think, with Fanny Braun, his girlfriend, who was very... he had a very tragic love affair at the time and was dying of tuberculosis.
Mary,
and
what,
he was living in that little room off the Spanish Steps in Rome, and dying of tuberculosis, I think, when he wrote that.
A good place to live. I don't know about a good place to die. Mary, when do you get a chance to recite it? Is it just for yourself? Do you have an audience? Who will be your audience?
Oh, well, sometimes my audience is just myself. I mean, just reading as I'm walking along. Sometimes my very first favorite poem from Keats was To Autumn. This was the poem that turned me on to poetry and changed my world, basically. And just one line of that poem sometimes comes to me as I'm driving past and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue. And I just watch on an autumn day the stubble plains as I drive by, and I'm one with Keats. It's the most amazing experience. It's like what the Hawaiians would say about mana, energy in words. When you speak the words aloud, they live again.
Mary, that's wonderful, and we're glad for your call. Jack, you know, there's one of the payoffs right there is that you look out through the poem at the world around, and it's enhanced, and you see it more deeply, and it's richer and fuller even as we drive through those stubbled fields.
Oh, yes. I can remember reading a Richard Wilbur's translation of The Misanthrope in a college classroom and coming out, and suddenly everything in the world there was fun in it. you wanted to make a couplet of everything that happened. I mean, it was like it was the music that was just in your head. And you know, with Keats, I mean, what he died, what, at 24? It's as if he wanted to say everything before his time was up. His letters are full of quotable bits, one of which I have taken with me through the years, which is, poetry is not so fine a thing as philosophy, as an eagle is not so fine a thing as the truth.
That's great. You know, and I've a line from Keats I've got right above my desk because maybe it lights up my world and job. He said, there's nothing stable in the world. Uproars your only music.
So
in this seat, I relate to that. Let's get Jane and Mary. Thank you for your call in Spokane. Jane, in Newport News, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you know?
Nice to be here.
Great to have you.
Well, my mother read us poetry. There were five children in my family. And every night before we went to bed, she read us poetry, and I still have the poetry book. And one of the favorite ones was Mud by Rose Fileman. And I have the picture of the little girl in my brain right now. And
let's hear the poem. Let's hear it.
My poems aren't.
Let's hear it. Mud.
Okay. Mud is very nice to feel, all squishy squash between the toes. I'd rather wade in wiggly mud than smell a yellow rose. Nobody else but the rosebush knows how nice mud feels between the toes.
That's great. That's a gift.
I recite that to my grandchildren. And as I say, in high school, I had to memorize the Shakespeare, just as your other callers have.
Yeah.
We memorized everything, and you can imagine, in French literature class. And I still remember the verses, and so it just does stay with you your whole life. That's why I love poetry.
Jane, thank you so much for calling. Jim Holt, there's Jane, whose mother read the poems to her. What about the influence of sort of passed down here? My dad had a favorite Kipling poem that I heard how many times. There's a widow in Sleepy Chester who weeps for her only son. I mean, I can't get that out of my head. I guess it's a gift, but it was sort of about a slaughter in a Burmese village. But parents hand it down or they don't.
Yeah, I ran into the poet Richard Howard the other day in Washington Square, and I said, I'm writing this article about learning poetry by heart, and do you do it? And he said, well, I know lots and lots of poetry. When I was a child, my parents would give me a dime for each poem I learned by heart. So to me, it was, you know, learning a poem by heart meant a dime's worth of candy, and it was, you know, it eased him into the memorization habit. By the way, you know, for a lot of people, or I shouldn't say a lot, some people have a rare gift. It's called hypermnesia. They can absorb a poem effortlessly. George Orwell was one of these. He would read a poem that, you know, when it really rang the bell, he could read 30 lines and it would be etched into his memory forever. And I know there are people, a friend of mine, Christopher Hitchens, who's a walking anthology of English verse, and he seems just to absorb it after one or two readings. And no matter how drunk he gets, he can still reel it off, you know, perfectly.
Hitchens,
I'd love to. We have a sort of, you know, very pretentious contest where we try to outdo each other and you know, bore each other with our memorized verse.
Bore us right now, Jim. What have you got? Give us another from your brain bank.
Well, there's a very cute one. It's a rondo by Lee Hunt called Jenny Kissed Me. Do you know the one?
I don't.
It's Jenny kissed me when we met, jumping from the chair she sat in. Time, you thief who loves to get sweets within your list, put that in. Say I'm weary, say I'm sad, say that health and wealth have missed me. Say I'm growing old, but add, Jenny kissed me. I think that's a rather sweet one. One more, another real short one.
This
I used to be a great habitué of New York nightlife clubs, and now I'm so old I don't go out at it anymore. And there's a wonderful poem by Byron that sort of marks the end of his nightlife era in his life. It's so we'll go no more roving so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast. And the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
You are keyed in, man. Your memory is working very well indeed. Wow.
I do these. My longest poem, which I certainly won't recite for you, is about 204 lines, and it's "Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came" by Browning. It's a dramatic monologue, and I commend it to everyone. By the way, it's a favorite poem of Stephen King. I'm told he has a whole series of books, the Dark Tower series. But it's a really some of the most haunting, nightmarish imagery. And it's only when you've memorized it and you imagine that you're Child Roland facing this sort of sinister entity that you know, emotionally, it just reverberates. And it's 204 lines, but if you break it up into, three or four smaller poems, it's not so hard to memorize.
Jack, there it is again, sort of life colored by what we carry in our minds. I think in a way that an iPod can't quite. I mean, I know, you know, lots of people have a soundtrack to their lives all the time now. The earbuds are in and it's either, you know, it's the show or it's music or something. But here it is from the inside out, coloring that world around us, illuminating.
From the inside out and through the best, you know, to quote Matthew Arnold, the best that has been thought and said. I mean, poetry lives for a reason. It embodies, it enacts truth in memorable language, and it becomes graven on the mind because that's the sort of the shape of inevitability. I mean, the lapidary statement. So I think that that probably, and I'm wondering about this, Jim. Do you notice your own prose taking on a certain distinction from the company you've been keeping?
That would be nice.
Heaven forbid. never allow poetry to creep into your prose. I think that's the prose, like poetry, should have a certain rhythmic pulse, certainly. But whenever you, whenever I write a sentence and there's an unintended rhyme, I go back and change one of the words to get rid of the, I mean, getting rid of rhymes and jingles and rhythm in prose is essential. And so I write a little bit of poetry. I tend to write light verse occasionally. It's like being a big P.G. Wodehouse fan. I'm a huge P.G. Wodehouse fan. And P.G. Wodehouse has all of these sort of, you know, great metaphors and similes. And you try to work them into your own prose. And then I always find out that the editors remove those from my prose before it gets printed. And I'm grateful they do.
Well, you start rhyming, you'll be kicked down the stairs in a hurry. Dick in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Dick.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I have... I've been memorizing a 35-stanza poem for the last 5 years, The Wreck of the Deutschland by Gerard Manley Hopkins. And I have several other poems by memory. But I do have a short poem I'd like to recite.
Oh, yes, please. Please, Dick.
Sure. It's called Pied Beauty, P-I-E-D, Beauty. And it goes... Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color, as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever's fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. That's it.
Wow, it is nearly, it is a prayer in nearly there, Dick.
Yes.
And who's your audience? I mean, maybe it's a million, or I don't know what it is at this moment, but who's your audience when you're at home or with friends, or is it just for yourself?
I'm a poet, and I meet with them regularly. So oftentimes, and I'm riding in a car with a friend, with my wife and my stepson when we're driving up to Vermont or somewhere. I'll recite all 35 stanzas of the Wreck of the Deutschland.
Well, you've got a great wife if she's sticking through you, but we'll look differently at the couple in the car next to us on the on the turnpike next time.
But there's one point that I want to make is Gerard Manley Hopkins, when he talks about he wants his poetry heard out loud, and he talks about pauses and lingering on words, and so to me that's something that's missing oftentimes, even when your guest there is reciting. It's a little too rapid for me. I am hard of hearing, but I think for people who are not familiar with the poem, a little more pausing and a little more lingering is important.
There's something from another time as well. I mean, limbic system's in full gear today, so, you know, the adrenaline may be higher on the air, but your point taken. And another kind of, mercy from another time or pacing. Dick, thanks very much for your call. Let me get one more right here. Lawrence in Johnston, Rhode Island. Lawrence, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
Well, what have you got?
Well, I feel a little guilty and reluctant because it does have some rhyming in it, so I don't know if you
Oh, we don't that. Care. It's poetry.
You know what it is? When I was a young kid, I did summer theater, and we were trying out for Alice in Wonderland, and they made us memorize the Jabberwocky as a monologue to kind of test our oratory in the theater.
Have you still got it?
A little lengthy. I still got it, but it's about a little boy, and now I ended up, I recited to my daughter. She's 20 months old, when she's falling asleep at night. So it's a little gruesome for a baby, but she doesn't really get it. So
we've got a minute and a half before the break. Give us as much as you can, Lawrence. Go.
All right, ready? "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the burrow groves, and the mome raths outgabe. Beware the jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch, and beware the jubjub bird, and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He stood there with vorpal sword in hand, long time the mansome foe he sought, so rested he by the tum-tum tree, and stood awhile and thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1-2, 1-2, and through, the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous day, kaloo calay, he chortled in his joy. And then do you repeat the very first line, which is, 'twas brillig in the slithy toves, did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the burrow groves and the mome raths outgabe. So it's a little weird, you know, some contrived
words. It's wonderful, but your little daughter, does she chortle at that? Does she know dad's up to something different? Does she roll her eyes?
I think so. You know, I mean, she's usually asleep by the end, but I just think it's so out of context with her that I have a lot of fun with it. You know, I imagine this little person alone in the woods up against this giant monster, and I don't know. I've never forgotten it. It's always stayed with me. So,
Lawrence, thank you.
It was pertinent, you know?
It's great. Totally pertinent. And I'm somehow imagining that decades from now, your daughter will have some rhythm of that, Jack, some sense of that, kind of, you know, carved in the back of her mind. When she hears it, she'll know it.
She'll say, my dad sure is slithy.
Yeah.
And she'll say it after a glass of wine.
Right.
The limbic system will get it right.
Drifting off to sleep, feeling all mimsy in the tum-tum trees there.
Breathe deep the gathering gloom. Watch lights fade from every room. Bedsitter people look back and lament. Another day's useless energy spent. Impassioned lovers wrestle as one. Lonely man cries for love and has none. New mother picks up and settles her son. Senior citizens wish they were young. Cold-hearted orb that rules the night removes the colors from our sight. Red is gray and yellow white, but we decide which is right and which is an illusion.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about learning poetry by heart, and we hope you will share yours with us. What do you think? Do we need to know poems by heart anymore when an iPod and earbuds can deliver them anytime, anywhere? And what's the payoff for knowing poems by heart? Jim Holt is with us. He's written an essay recently called Got Poetry? The New York Times Book Review, celebrating his own sort of romance with the memorized poem and its payoff. What do you think? Do you run from poetry or savor it out loud in the shower, on a walk, in the car? Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's hear a little different sound. Here's Saul Williams, a hip-hop and spoken word performance artist, of course, memorizing. Here's performing at the Double Door Club in Chicago, 2004, reciting part of his poem called Coded Language, about music, time, and reimagining history.
Breakbeats have been the missing link, connecting the diaspora community to its drum-moving past. Whereas the quantized drum has allowed the whirling mathematicians to calculate the ever-changing distance between rock and stardom. Whereas the velocity of spinning vinyl, cross-faded, spun backwards, and re-released at the same given moment of recorded history, yet at a different moment in time's continuum, has allowed history to catch up with the present. We do hereby declare reality unkept by the changing standards of dialogue. Statements such as, keep it real, especially when punctuating or anticipating modes of ultra-violence inflicted psychologically or physically, will henceforth be seen as retroactive and not representative of the individually determined is.
All right, Saul Williams there reciting in Chicago. Jim Holt, is it cultural? Can you imagine yourself with that mouthful, that speed?
I could make no sense of that. My problem is when I read a poem on the page, I understand it a little bit. When I recite it from memory, I understand it a lot. When I hear someone else recite, I don't get it at all. So that's why I think it's essentially a private pleasure. You know, I thought maybe people would like to hear me recite poetry. No. I discovered, you know, it's like, you know, turning on a fire hose. You disperse a crowd when you start reciting. But I do have one friend, a Wall Street bond trader I wrote about in the piece, and he loves my recitations, and he invites me to the Grand Havana Cigar Club, which is the top of a building high above Midtown. And it's where the masters of the universe meet Hollywood stars. And here I am, you know, reciting Yeats, you know, the unpurged images of day recede. And he calls her, he says, with the waitress, come over here, listen to my friend read this Yeats poem. You know, she rolls her eyes, and I'm sort of cringing in embarrassment.
But, what do you think it is that captures the bond trader, the Wall Street guy, about, I don't know, you reciting poetry there?
He says that I bring the poems alive. But as one of your callers pointed out, due to nervousness, I always go through them way too quickly. By the way, it's fun learning poems in other languages, too. And I have a little understanding of French. I've been trying to learn French all my life, but I've memorized a huge number of French poems. And one of the – by Baudelaire, I'll just give
Good.
You the
yes,
first
please.
Few lines. And here's the way I was doing it when I didn't know how to do it. I would say, je suis comme le roi d'un pays pluvieux, riche. Okay. And so I thought, I want to see how a real Frenchman would recite that. So I went on the internet and I found a recording of the actor Louis Jordan reciting it. And here's how it's supposed to go. Je suis comme le roi d'un pays pluvieux, riche mais impuissant, je n'ai pourtant très vieux, qui de ses précepteurs méprisant les courbettes, sans oui avec ses chiens, comme avec d'autres bêtes, etc. I'm Baudelaire being channeled by Charles de Gaulle there.
My father-in-law is French, and when he begins to recite, and does because his generation was taught in French schools, I'm in a different universe. You begin to take me there. Jack, are you traveling? Are you going transatlantic there, Jack?
I am going transatlantic. Actually, I'm going to South Africa with Hilaire Belloc, who wrote couplets. And the good of them is you get it in two lines. This about the Zulu Wars. Thank God that we have got the Gatling gun and they have not.
Oh, and we have got a guttural language, and I don't know about theirs. Let's get Lynn in Hanawha Falls, New York. Lynn, you're on the air.
Oh, goodness.
Hi, Lynn.
I had the courage to call because I was so excited about this. I've started memorizing poems recently to test my memory, which I thought I was having problems with.
Mm.
And I saw this book, Committed to Memory, 100 Best Poems to Memorize, edited by John Hollander, and it's put out by the Academy of American Poets.
Okay.
And but they're not all, and I thought, well, that's good. They've chosen some that aren't too hard to memorize.
Did you give it a try? How's it going? Have you got some?
I have 10 out of 100. I've got only 90 to go.
Wow, that's pretty good already.
Yeah, I got to live longer. I'm 75, so I got to work on it.
Is it helping your memory, can you tell?
Well, the amazing part is I'm finding that it's, you know, it's not hard. I'm learning these 10. And the very when I opened the book, I don't have a favorite. I just love them all. They take each one takes you into a different world. And the first one, I saw the first line of the Elizabeth Bishop sonnet, and it caught me because it expressed something that I feel. Do you want to hear that one?
Oh, absolutely we do. Please.
Okay. I am in need of music that would flow over my fretful, feeling fingertips, over my bitter, tainted, trembling lips, with melody deep, clear, and liquid slow. Oh, for the healing swaying, old and low, of some song sung to rest the tired dead. A song to fall like water on my head, and over quivering limbs, dream flushed to glow. There is a magic made by melody, a spell of rest and quiet breath and cool heart that sinks through fading colors deep to the subaqueous stillness of the sea and floats forever in a moon-green pool held in the arms of rhythm and of sleep.
Lynn, I hope you memorize all 100. We don't get the subaqueous stillness of the sea here every day. That's
yeah,
awesome.
I know.
Lovely.
It's amazing, isn't it? The words that they...
It's absolutely beautiful, and I hope you keep memorizing. Thank you very much for sharing that, Lynn.
And you know, that's an illustration of what Pope thought was the genius of poetry. How did he put it, Jim? What oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed.
Yeah.
That's the genius of poetry.
Get us in that vein. Kylie in Providence, Rhode Island. Kylie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Earlier in the broadcast, you were making a few jokes about wooing the ladies with poem, memorized poems, but I wooed my own boyfriend with a poem, and I wanted to point
out. How did you do it? Give us the what was the situation?
Well, it's 6 years ago, so now I only remember one line of the poem, but it's an E.E. Cummings poem,
uh-huh.
And I was in college, and so had poems and whatnot all posted all over the wall, and he asked me my favorite, and I said, oh, it's this E.E. Cummings poem, and I recited the poem, and the line that clinched the deal is, and kisses are a better fate than wisdom.
And off we go, baby.
The gentleman can be swayed as well.
Absolutely. Robin Williams has got nothing on you. That's really great. Kylie, thank you for that. Kathy in Rockport, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to speak about the fact that I was a school nurse for 15 years at a prep school, and I used poetry a lot. Our department was not always very busy, and the teachers were, so many times we would get troubled students in or just students that had something on their mind, and you could kind of sense that. And somehow or other, I could use poetry a lot to kind of draw them out. And one of the ones I used a lot, and it's ingrained upon my memory, is Revelation by Robert Frost. I think it helped many a gay student to come to terms and to be able to speak about where he was at.
Can you help us with it right now? Have you got it at the tip of your tongue?
I do.
Let's have it.
I always will. It's called Revelation. We make ourselves a place apart, behind light words that tease and flout. But oh, the agitated heart, till someone really find us out. 'Tis pity if the case require, or so we say, that in the end we speak the literal to inspire the understanding of a friend. But so with all, from babes that play at hide-and-seek to God afar, so all who hide too well away must speak and tell us where they are. And it's a little bit of distilled wisdom, I think, that they would carry with them. And a few weeks later, maybe they'd come in and you know, we'd get at the heart of what was troubling them.
I
have to laugh at Jim because when I retired, that was one of my resolutions to memorize more poetry. I'm afraid I failed a little bit at it. But
well, be inspired. Take him as an inspiration today. That's wonderful. Kathy, thank you. Jim Holt, I mean, there's an interesting facet here, the way reciting poetry, Kathy saw it, and it's easy to imagine, can sort of hold a door open, crack it open ajar into things we don't normally speak of or articulate.
I you're making a very profound philosophical point. I was going to drag the discussion back down to the utilitarian level. Yeah. Is it any good for you? What's the takeaway? What are the benefits? And one of the woman who was your caller who had memorized 10 of the 100 poems out of the volume,
yes.
And she said, you know, she felt that it was enhancing her memory. There is evidence that learning poetry by heart improves your working memory, which is a very important part of fluid intelligence, a major component of IQ. And I often feel it when I'm on a line of a poem that I've memorized, and I can't remember whether it ends with mysteries or mystery, singular or plural.
Yeah.
And so, how do I figure that out? I go back two lines earlier and remember that line ended with C's, S-E-A-S.
Mm.
So, so it must be mysteries,
uh-huh,
plural.
Uh-huh.
And so you're holding, a couple of dozen semantic items in your head at the same time. And this is very important in thinking abstractly and problem solving and so forth. So there may well be a big cognitive payoff in doing that. The evidence is still a little bit ambiguous. But in my own case, I feel that I just have more mnemonic horsepower. I can hold a whole poem in my head, and I can kind of see it all at once, and I can rotate it and look at different facets of it. This is all nonsense I'm talking, of course, but it's good to feel that.
Use that memory muscle, and it feels stronger. Here's Monica writing in about her Marine Corps father, who was a bomber pilot in the Pacific Theater. This is at our website, onpointradio.org. And she says he was a dive bomber pilot, but he loved poetry and made us memorize it, everything from the funny lines of Ogden Nash to Longfellow to Shakespeare. Now he's gone, she says, but whenever she hears it or recites it, she remembers him, loves him even more. Clearly there's linkage here that's very strong. I recall my grandfather, Jack, it was Psalms that he would recite, Psalms from the Bible, the Old Testament, 23rd Psalm. I mean, we were on the farm, we had sheep, and he would always the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, maketh me to lie down in green pastures. And I cannot hear that without kind of feeling that presence, being in his presence. Let's get a call from Idaho Falls, Idaho. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What have you got, Jesse?
I've been reading Stephen Crane poems since I was in eighth grade when I had to do some poetry projects.
Mm-hmm.
And his poems are all really short, so I memorized a bunch of them. And there's one that I've always really liked. And it starts, I saw a man pursuing the horizon. Round and round they sped. I was disturbed at this. I accosted the man. It is futile, I said. You can never. You lie, he cried, and ran on.
and off he goes. Jesse, I love it. Thank you very much. Let's get one from Melrose, Massachusetts. And Jen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you know?
I had to memorize a series of poems in my French class in high school, and mostly kept them to myself, but had an experience this past summer when a loved one was in a coma, and I spent a lot of time by her side, and I found that when I ran out of stories to tell, the thing that kept popping into my mind were all of these French poems. So I spent a good deal of time this summer reciting these French poems, which once had been just sort of, kept private. And
reciting them to your comatose friend, Jen.
Yes, that's correct.
Uh-huh. Did she?
And I thought I would recite this poem for you by Paul Verlaine, which is one of the poems I shared with her this summer.
Yes, please. Let us hear it.
You'll have to excuse the rusty accent.
It's all right.
It goes something like this. Les sanglots longs des violons de l'automne blessent mon cœur d'une langueur monotone. Toutes suffocantes et blême quand sonne l'heure, je me souviens des jours anciens et je pleure. Et je m'en vais au vent mauvais qui m'emporte, déjà, de là, pareil à la feuille morte.
Paul Verlaine, did your friend awaken from her coma?
She did, yes, and she's very much back with us today, and quite miraculously so. I can't say it's because of my poetry at all, but certainly it couldn't have hurt anything.
It's beautiful, and we're grateful for you sharing. We've only got a couple minutes left. Jim Holt, give us another. What have you got? It can't be as long as, the Iliad and the Odyssey, but we've got 2 minutes.
A very short one.
Yes,
how about William Blake? O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. I love that one. And there's a wonderful analysis of that by Paul Fussell. And he says, there's a little bit of hope in the poem when you get to crimson joy, and you feel that it might end on a hopeful note. And then dark secret. There's an interruption in the rhythm. Mm-hmm. Both dark and seek are stressed, and secret should be unstressed. And so, according to Fussell, this closes off all hope, and it means that this sort of sinister worm has triumphed, and death has triumphed over joy. And I can feel that when I recite it. I'm sure I didn't convey that, but and you know that those are the subtleties that you pick up with repetition. And there's this. It's hidden, subtle music in every good poem, and it's all about modulating the standard meter. What you don't get that from what I was made to memorize a lot of Edgar Allan Poe, and there, that has that sort of, it's like a popular song, many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea, a maiden, right. Blah blah blah, beautiful Annabel Lee, and there it's monotonous because it sticks to the rhythm, but it's a Blake or a Yeats who can reverse your rhythmic expectations to intensify meaning, and that's why it's so much fun to
give
to
us
learn
a couple
poetry.
More lines from something. We've just got a few seconds here, but a couple of lines to go out on, Jim.
Oh, well, I just say that Groucho Marx said the only poem he learned by heart was the one that begins 30 days hath September, because it was the only poem that contained any useful information.
So, oh, thanks, Groucho.
To go off on a note of bathos there.
not magic, but yeah, I've used that one. Who hasn't? Jack Media, last thought on the spoken poetry of memory here.
In the world of all their wish, there shall be no more land, say fish.
Okay, we'll take that to the bank with Groucho Marx. Jim Holt, author of Stop Me If You've Heard This. It's always great to have you. Thanks very much for being with us today, Jim.
Oh, thank you.
And Jack, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.